Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
At one time, you were the only
black cannabis producer in the state of Oregon. You know, we were blessed. We were one of the first 8 licenses in the state when we first started in 2016 actually. And it probably took 8 months before there was another minority cannabis producer in general in the state. And then, you know, I go to conventions all around the country, and it's very rare for me to see more than 1 or 2 or 3 people of color. Yeah. At the entire convention. It's almost amazing when you consider the history of cannabis in this country.
What if your whole life you saw other black men going to jail and doing hard time for selling marijuana while their white counterparts got off with a warning or a slap on the wrist? Antonio Harvey, former NBA player and commentator and currently CEO of Legends Brand, found an investment opportunity that he just couldn't pass up and became one of Portland, Oregon's only legal black cannabis producers. But what if you found out that your decision to enter the world of cannabis cultivation would mean that you would be the lone black male in any space where your peers were doing business for years? Would you back out knowing how painful it can be to be the only one in the room? Or would you encourage other black men and women to join you, showing them that this is an opportunity to finally level the playing field? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. Antonio Harvey, how are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We're doing great over here in Studio City, California. And I know we're talking to you from what city in Oregon?
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon.
Portland.
So, Antonio, what was your first concert?
Ooh, my first concert was Keith Sweat.
Yes.
Keith Sweat.
Yes.
Must have been like 1986. It was at the Biloxi Coliseum in Biloxi, Mississippi. Mm. And I snuck out. My mom didn't give me permission to go, so I waited for her to go to sleep. Uh-oh. And snuck out, and lo and behold, she was waiting for me to get back when
Stop.
I got home.
What was she waiting for you with? Was she waiting with a belt in her hand?
Well, fortunately, I was like 16 and probably 6'10".
Yeah.
So it was more like a stern talking to, mm-hmm. but it mattered because it was my mom and, you know, the respect level was there. So, yeah, my first concert was Keith Sweat. Mm-hmm. I think I saw like 15 minutes of the concert, by the way, and then it was over.
Oh, that's so funny. I was saying mom's was hip. She knew exactly what was happening, huh?
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. Always did. She was always a step ahead of me.
Yeah. Oh, bless her heart. So I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is the only one in the room. But I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey. So speaking of concerts, Hun, you used to like... Did you used to like go to concerts and smoke a lot of weed?
I don't know if I went to concerts and smoked weed or I smoked weed at a lot of concerts.
Ah, right? Okay. Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. So I had my value system a little crossed up at the time, I think.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But you enjoyed your cannabis.
I did. In 1992, I wanted to open a small coffee shop called the Wake and Bake Cafe in Park City, Utah. At the time, nobody was doing anything like that. But I really thought it was the answer to the anti-Starbucks crew.
Right.
We needed a place with some couches and some good suites, a place where people could hang out and be alike.
Yes. So tell me, wake and bake is a stoner term. What does that mean?
Wake and bake was when you just rolled over when you woke up and you hit the bong and then had coffee. And I lived in Park City, Utah. So we would watch the Weather Channel, cross our fingers for snow, and then we would go skiing all day long.
Yeah.
Smoke weed and ski powder.
The Weather Channel, that's a thing of the past.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it still exists, but it's not like people watch it anymore, right?
No, we worship that thing.
Yeah.
We cross our fingers every day.
Well, you'll see why this is relevant in a minute. Antonio Harvey is our guest today, and Antonio is a former NBA player. His playing career spanned 23 seasons. Is that right, Antonio?
Well, it was 23 seasons overall in the NBA. It was 11 as a player and then 12 as a broadcaster.
Okay.
But the total time spent in the NBA was 23 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. You are the much beloved analyst or color commentator for the Portland Trail Blazers from 2005 to 2016. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. I had to look up color commentator. I didn't really know what that meant. And I was like, because he's of color? Like... Is that what it is?
So that actually came up once.
Uh-huh. True
story. You know, I live in Oregon.
Oh, yes.
And Oregon is a relatively progressive state. But there are some pockets of Oregon that aren't so progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing a radio tour where we went around to our affiliate stations, which are other stations that broadcast the games in their local market.
Yeah.
So we were out and about and we go to this radio station that's kind of remote. And the host for the morning show says to me, how does it feel, you know, your first however many years it was at the time, being a colored analyst? And
awkward.
I just, yeah, well, you know, it would have been had I not been in the right, you know, mind space. But I just kind of let it roll off. I was like, well, you know, I'm more of a color analyst. And then I just kind of went on from there.
Oh, but see, you're such a cool guy. I can totally see you just letting it roll off and being understanding and generous as you are.
You give me a lot of credit. We've known each other. You know, we met almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I was definitely not the easygoing person that I am today. I had to grow into this mindset, but you know, it started back then and I've been able to evolve over time to get to where I am.
Yeah. Well, the only way I judge people, actually, that's probably not true. But the way that I judge them at first is how they are with me. And you were always so sweet with me and just like a nice guy. So that's what I think of you as, is the sweet, generous personality.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. And we have to judge some people by the actions that they take with others as well. But that'll be another conversation. Mm-hmm. So a legend is a retired basketball player. Is that correct?
So a legend for me is anyone who achieved, you know, whether that is an actor or an actress or a musician or you, for instance, in your previous life, you know, as a publicist, you achieved.
Yes.
And once you achieve and you commit yourself to that achievement, legend status is almost a byproduct of the dedication that it takes to achieve. So we leave it at anyone who achieves, be it at the college level or the NFL professional level, NBA or whatever that may be, mm-hmm. or even if you're an actor or an actress who has managed to make a successful career out of what you do, a scientist, a legend is a legend. It's all about what avenue you chose to be a legend in.
So is that why you chose that name for your brand?
That is exactly
yes.
Why we chose that name. We wanted to, you know, we thought about different names. The only name that I was absolutely adamant it wouldn't be was mine. Mm-hmm. Anything else I was okay with, but really legend stood out because it speaks to what we're trying to get accomplished. And we, you know, we'll get into that as we go
yes.
through
yeah.
what legends is. But yeah, legends is anyone who achieves. And what we are is a cannabis-infused nutraceutical company. You know, my background obviously is sports. It's what I did all my life.
Right.
And then at a certain point, there was a pivot into the cannabis industry.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're trying to marry the two. And it's not like this is something new. I mean, let's keep it real. Athletes have been using cannabis for as long as there's
been
athletes in cannabis.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's always an interesting thing, though, as I've gotten to know more about the plant and more about the people who utilize the plant. In the society today, there's three markets. There's the illegal market, there's the medical market, and then there is the recreational market. And what I've kind of learned over the last 5 years of really being into it and studying and learning is that there really isn't a recreational market, and there's only an illegal market because the country has chosen so.
Mm.
Almost everybody who uses cannabis uses it on a medical level. Most people are fighting some sort of pain, mm-hmm. whether it's an emotional or psychological or spiritual pain or physical pain, but everybody is trying to cope with something.
Right.
And cannabis is a really good escape because it's not detrimental to the body like alcohol,
mm-hmm.
but it gives you a lot of that relief that you would get if you were using alcohol. So I don't look at cannabis as a recreational market. It's all medicinal if used the right way. And that's where Legends was born. It was figuring out that there are ways to utilize cannabis in a constructive and productive and non-illegal way, I guess is the
right.
best way to say it,
right.
a way that is acceptable to society as a whole.
Interesting. So just to go back to your history a little bit, you were born in Mississippi, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What was the town?
Pascagoula, Mississippi, about as far south, directly south as you can get, and certainly is about as far south Dixie as you can get. Because, you know, once you get down to the southern parts of Florida, you're not really in the Dixieland anymore. You're
right.
in a whole other country.
Mm-hmm.
But being in the southern part of Mississippi, it was interesting, I think, is the best way to describe it.
Yeah, you were in the deep south.
Deep.
And how do you feel like that experience growing up there? How long were you there? Sorry.
I grew up there. I was there until I was 18.
Okay.
I left for college at 18, I think it was 5 days after I graduated from high school.
Wow.
And I only went back to visit after that.
Mm-hmm.
I never moved back there on a permanent basis. It was a lot. I'm trying to think of the right way to describe it. I didn't realize how oppressive it was until I got away.
Yeah.
And then you see the rest of the world and how other people live. And it's like, wow, how did I make it through that? It was amazing.
Yeah. I had kind of the opposite experience. I grew up in a black middle-class neighborhood in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When I saw how the rest of the world lived, I was shocked. Like, there weren't wealthy black neighborhoods, not wealthy, but just middle class, where people had porches and safe streets and jobs. And, you know, I thought everybody was like that. And very shocked to find out that there's so much more segregation between socioeconomic and race and blah, blah, blah. And that not, you know, that wasn't representative of the world we live in. Wait, can you say that word again that you said earlier? Is it
nutraceutical?
Nutraceutical. Okay.
Yes.
I just want to remember that so that I can come back to that because I've not heard that word before. All right. So you were with the Lakers when I met you, right?
Yes.
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 And so how long did you play for them?
2 years, my first 2 years in the league. And I, you know, I'm not a boisterous person, but I do like to point out from time to time that I was the first undrafted rookie in the history of the Lakers to start opening night.
Yes, that is actually in your Wikipedia page that you started opening night. So I knew that was a big deal because I don't know why else they would have put that in there. So congratulations for that. And then you came across my feed because of The Last Dance. There's a YouTube video where you're being interviewed and you talk about this encounter with Michael Jordan. I guess when the Blazers, I think, were playing.
No, it was in Vancouver. I was with the Vancouver Grizzlies. They were an expansion team.
Okay.
Yes, I was in Vancouver.
So can you just tell me a little bit about that? Because I thought it was a great story.
So there's two parts to the story. First, there's the interaction, my first interaction with Michael Jordan. So growing up, you know, obviously Michael Jordan was Michael Jordan from 84 until he retired in the late 90s or mid 90s.
Yeah.
And, you know, 1988, I go to college. And so Jordan is really entering the height of his career. And 1993 is my rookie season. So I am in college through Jordan's really that hot run where they got where the Bulls were the Bulls and Michael Jordan was Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
And so I had all of his posters on my walls in college and I was that guy. Like I idolized the guy. So we get to Vancouver and, well, let me back up. My rookie year, 1993, was the year he went to play baseball. So I didn't get to see Mike.
Right.
I didn't get to play against Mike my rookie year.
Yeah.
He came back to the NBA like two games after we played him with the Lakers.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm in my third year and I'm finally getting a chance to see and play against Michael Jordan. The Grizzlies at the time were one of the few teams in the NBA with their own dedicated practice facility. So the first part of the story is we go into our practice and lo and behold, on the court next to us, but on the other side of this huge wall, the Chicago Bulls are practicing. And after practice, I go into the weight room. I'm getting my post-practice workout in. I'm ready to go. I get on the bench. I'm getting my bench press on. I'm getting strong, ready for the game tomorrow night. And I sit up from the bench, and there on the bench next to me is Black Jesus, a.k.a. Michael Jordan. For the next 30 minutes, I think he must have thought I was half-witted because I just sat there and stared at him with this. I'm sure it was a lustful look in my eyes, right, if I'm being honest.
Right.
But I couldn't help myself. So that's the first part of the story. And, and like literally it was 30 minutes of me just sitting there on the bench watching Jordan work out, like completely captivated by the man who was my basketball idol at the time.
Yeah.
And then so fast forward to the next night, and this is where it got really interesting. So the next night we're playing Chicago, and for whatever reason, Mike's kind of checked out. Right. He's not having a great night. I want to say he was like 4 for 16 from the field. And you can actually look this game up on YouTube, by the way, like the actual game.
Yeah.
So he's playing really poorly. He's not shooting the ball well. And we're winning. And we're going into the fourth quarter and we're winning. We're midway through the fourth quarter, still winning. And our point guard, Derek Martin, who's a great dude, he had been with Mike on the set of Space Jam. So Mike, when he was, as anybody who saw The Last Dance knows, Mike had a court built on the lot of, I think it was Warner Brothers.
Yeah, it was Warner Brothers.
So they built what they called the Space Dome, and guys would go in and work out and play pickup games with Mike. And Derek was one of the guys who was there with Mike. So we get into the game. We're winning. We're midway through the fourth quarter. We're feeling really good about it. And Derek starts talking trash to MJ. Now that we've seen The Last Dance, everybody understands how competitive this dude was.
Right?
And I mean, he was like sitting there half checked out of the game. He was on the bench, checked out. Grizzlies win, right? It's a great game. Great day in Vancouver. Yay, parade, all of that stuff. And Derek starts talking trash to MJ. And he gets up. And I didn't find this out till after the fact. Checks himself back into the game. And then I think he went 8 for 8 or something like that from the field to finish the game. He scored 24 points in the last 8 minutes of the quarter. They end up winning the game. But the best part was he turns and hits a shot to kind of ice things. Yeah. And he looks to our bench and says, "Shut up, you little bitch." And that was the, that was MJ. That was MJ to a T.
Right.
And it was absolutely amazing for a guy like me who idolized this man.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong. Once we got into competition, it was competition.
Right.
but it was still MJ.
Yeah.
And it was that was probably, if I were going to say, I would say that's the highlight of my career, because it was literally my idol. Mm. And anytime you get a chance to meet your idol, let me think about that. I want to be honest with you, Laura. I don't want anybody to pull up an interview someplace else and say, ah, oh, he said this and this isn't true. There was one other time that I got starstruck. It was on a flight from Europe, and it was Isaac Hayes. He was sitting in the seat in front of me. Mm-hmm. It was a 10-hour flight, and I literally sat the entire flight trying to figure out how to say hello to Isaac Hayes, because he was that big of a personality to me. And it was funny, because when I finally said hello, he said, "Oh yeah, Antonio, nice to meet you."
Mm, he knew.
He was a Laker fan.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
So he knew who I was, yeah. But I don't think he was back there trying to figure out the words to say hello the way I was.
Probably not. So thank you for that. I love that story, and it's just really relevant right now, because Scotty and I are watching The Last Dance too. We're parsing that. We're actually watching it with our whole family on Sunday, so we're behind everybody else. Speaking of families, can you tell me about yours?
Yeah. I've got, I've got four kids, a wife and four kids. Two, my older kids from a previous marriage. One is a recent graduate. She graduated in December from Cal State Bakersfield. She was a college soccer player, and she's actually going to, I hope she doesn't get mad at me for saying it. She says I'm going to jinx her, but I don't think I am. She's going to Portugal to play professional soccer in the fall. And then I've got, my 20-year-old will be a sophomore at Ventura College, football player.
Okay.
He's an anomaly. He's a 6'9" wide receiver. He's never played basketball. He never played a day in his life. It was one of those situations where I was afraid that he would stop growing at 6'6", right? And now, you know, 6'6" as a basketball player is really very average.
Yeah.
And I didn't want people comparing him to me. Mm-hmm. I wanted him to be able to live his own life and have his own identity. So we chose football. And then he had a 3-inch growth spurt after his senior year in college. And so now he's 6'9", but he's a really good athlete. He's a better athlete than I was. And he's super tall. He's got great hands. I think he's got a bright future.
Yeah.
Then I've got a 17-year-old who's also, he's a 6'4 sophomore wide receiver at his high school. And then I've got an 8-year-old who is literally none of the things that any of my other kids were and are, but he's really smart.
Yeah. You have three boys and a girl.
Three boys and a girl, yes.
And how tall are you, Antonio?
6'10".
6'10". Okay, so your son's right up under you.
Yes. He claims we're the same height, but I don't give him that credit.
Probably does he have hair?
He's got huge, yes. Yeah.
So
yes,
probably
big
with
hair, you know,
his hair, he's taller.
He's right there.
Yeah.
Yes.
This episode of The Only One in the Room is being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Voyage AC.
Yep. Here's the thing I like best about Voyage AC.
What's that, hon?
Well, you know, you're not the easiest person to buy presents for.
Huh? Okay, I am a little particular.
A little, hon. Anyway, since you brought me to Voyage AC that first time, I don't have to search online or run around from store to store guessing and stressing about what to get you.
Why? Because I love everything they carry.
Absolutely. It's a sure thing. You love the Opera perfume. You love the monogram clutch.
Yeah.
And you love, love, love those fuzzy slides.
I do. It's true, hon. And you know my birthday's coming up next month.
I know, honey. And I've already put in a call to Melanie Apple at Voyage AC to see what's new.
Oh, that makes me so happy, hon. Voyage AC is your one-stop shopping for self-care items and gifts and hand-poured candles, diffusers, dope slides, clutches, and beach bags, clothes, and any fragrance you could dream of. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VoyageEtcie.com.
And oh, hey, Melanie's willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now. That is 10% off everything they buy.
That's awesome. But how do they get it? Enter The Only One in the Room on their website?
That's right. All they have to do is enter The Only One when they make their purchase. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of artisanal candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
Are you ready to shop? Rakuten's Big Give Week is back. Get 15% back at hundreds of stores, and it's all happening this week, May 6th to May 13th. It's the perfect time to shop for everything on your list for spring and summer, like clothing, outdoor gear, and travel. I know I'm using this week to stock up on some warmer weather essentials at Ray-Ban and Ulta, and I love that Rakuten even helps me save on travel at sites like hotels.com. Rakuten really is the best way to shop, and you can save even more by stacking cash back on top of deals. Plus, during Big Give Week, that cash back is bigger than ever. With Rakuten, membership is free, and when you sign up and shop today, you get an extra 10% cash back boost. That's an extra 10% cash back on top of the 15% cash back. You won't see higher cash back rates than these. Go to Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app. R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Shoppers get it. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
So when I first looked you up, I think when I called you, I said you were a farmer. Are you a farmer? Do you consider yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And we refer to our grow facility as the farm. That's exactly how we refer to it. Yes.
Okay, great. So tell me what that's like. What's your day-to-day like on a cannabis farm?
So cannabis is one of those weird plants where if you don't take care of it, you can harm it, but you can't kill it. And if you overtake care of it, you can harm it, but you can't kill it. Like there's a really fine area right in the middle. And my wife handles literally all of that. I am not a meticulous person. I am a 10,000 or 30,000 foot person. My wife is minute by minute. So she handles almost all of the growing. And my job is to be the maintenance man in the building. So for me, my day to day is getting up about 5:30, 6 o'clock. I'm at the farm by 7. Mm-hmm. My wife comes in about 8:30. I get all the food ready, and then she gets the kids off to school, and then I get to the farm and make sure that all of the equipment and things like that is in working order, so that when she gets there, she can just get right to the stuff she has to do. Right. And then it's a lot of plant maintenance where you're making sure that the plant nutrients, you know, the feeding system is right, and the, you know, the watering and the drying room is the right temperature and the right humidity, and the clones have been done right. Mm. It's really a lot of
science.
Little science.
Yeah.
It really is. But it's, you know, played, like I said, like we said earlier, 23 years in and around the NBA. I've never done anything I've enjoyed more than being involved in the cannabis industry. And it's almost exclusively on the production, growth, running of the farm side. Mm. It's an unbelievably calming experience to be around these plants.
Interesting. I mean, I can tell that just from talking to you. Like, you're not a guy who has day-to-day contact with high-level stress. Or it doesn't seem like that anyway.
Nah, you know, I'll be 50 in about 3 weeks.
Oh.
I'm black and I'm from Mississippi. I've already done more than anybody anticipated I was going to do. So literally everything I've done most of my life, I'm playing with house money. So why not enjoy it? Why not let the small stuff roll off your back, right? And keep it pushing. Work hard. You know, one of my partners says to me all the time, you know, how can you always be so positive? And my response is, hey, first and foremost, I'm playing with house money. Mm-hmm. Second, I know that if I work hard enough, I can fix whatever things come my way.
Yeah, I love that. So I have kind of a two-part question for you. We talked a little bit about people in Oregon smoking a lot of weed, because you say there's just like a lot of weed smoking up there, right? But I wanted to talk to you about the jailblazers. And I think that's a term that you take offense to. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yes. So can you just give me a little back? Because I think it goes part and parcel with the fact that there's a lot of weed smoking up there. And then you have these athletes that live there that also smoked weed. And you can take the story from there.
Well, it's a really complicated story. And I'm certain that if any Blazer fans, especially older Blazer fans, hear this, some of them are going to take offense to it, but it's the truth. Oregon is one of those pseudo-liberal cities, right? Mm-hmm. Like, for the most part, everybody here is quote-unquote woke, right? And they're all aware of social injustice. But there's a lot of people up until very recent times that were okay with it, right? And so you get this influx of black men, young black men, right? 22, 23 years old. And all of a sudden they get this reputation for doing things that are outrageous, like smoking marijuana. Ooh, it's Oregon. Right. Every 23-year-old smokes marijuana in Oregon. There were, you know, and that's what I think frustrates me is because there was about an 8-year span where the term jailblazers was being used. And in that 8-year span, there were maybe 3 incidences of problems. But if you were to take any team, any segment of society at 23 years old, over the course of 8 years, you took 15 guys, you're going to have 3 or 4 incidents between those 3 or 4 guys. Now I'm talking about incidents that didn't involve some sort of a cannabis situation. You know, there were some things that were just wrong, and I don't defend any of the truly wrong things.
Yeah.
But like, there were 2 guys that were pulled over driving from Seattle down to Portland, and they were smoking weed in the back of the car.
Right.
Now keep in mind, they weren't driving, right? They hired a driver.
Right.
So they were being safe. And they were driving and smoking weed. Well, it's Oregon, Washington. It's the Pacific Northwest. That's what people do here.
Right.
So what's really so bad about that? To me, it was that underlying racism in this area, where I'm going to hold those young black men to a very different standard than I would a white counterpart.
Mm-hmm. And that was
Rasheed
Wallace, right?
I wasn't going to see.
Well, it's on the net. I mean, it's not like.
Right.
But it was Rasheed Wallace and Damon Stoudemire, and you weren't the only person who came to their defense. There were a lot of people who thought that that was an infraction.
Right. And how about this one? There was another situation where the police showed up at Damon's house once, and because there was an alarm. Right. There was an alarm and they said the door was open, not unlocked, but open. I don't know how it was open because nobody was home, and who leaves their front door open when nobody's home? Anyway, then the police, because the door was open, they felt free to go into his house. But then that wasn't good enough either. Let's actually look through his stuff until we find something. And I think they found some cannabis somewhere in the house, right? I would imagine that if they had gone to 10 houses in Damon's neighborhood, they would have found marijuana in 7 of them because it's Oregon, right? And then they made this whole big deal about it, and they almost ruined this dude's life, this dude's career. Over something as silly as him smoking weed.
Right.
I take strong offense because I know I played with most of those guys that were on those teams, and none of them were bad human beings. They were all young men, just so happened to be black, smoking a little weed in Oregon. Right. Well, shit. If that's the situation, you'd have to arrest everybody.
Right. Right. And that actually leads me to the next thing I wanted to talk about. And I was just going to read a quote. It's not your quote. It's John Ehrlichman, who was President Nixon's domestic policy chief. So during a 1994 interview, he says that Nixon had two enemies. The Nixon campaign had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. And Ehrlichman was quoted as saying, "We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against war or black. But by getting the public to associate hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing them both heavily, we could disrupt these communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." And that was the beginning of the 1970 war on drugs, which was, in fact, a war on black people and anti-war left, and in a war that is continuing today. Are you in agreement with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Obviously, I wasn't there during the time. Well, I might have been born about then. Mm. But the bigger point is that's exactly what it was. And the really sad thing is it continues to this day.
Yeah.
You know, that to me was a part of the vilification of black men in America.
Mm-hmm.
It started, you know, it started long before then, but that was just a continuation of that, you know, We're living through some very difficult times in terms of race relations in this country right now, but it's important to understand context. Right. And you look at what's going on, the George Floyd situation, the Trayvon Martin situation, the Breonna Taylor situation. I could run a list of names that's, you know, a page deep, mm-hmm. and we could go through this. But when you start talking about that, it was these types of things, these types of insidious actions that created this environment. Because when you vilify black men for something as simple as cannabis, you vilify them for everything.
Yeah.
You criminalize them as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is one of those really touchy subjects because I always want to make sure that I don't overstep, but we use the term racist so frequently that it's lost a lot of its power.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I don't think that a lot of what we see from police officers in particular is racist, because racism in and of itself requires forethought, right? Like, you have to wake up in the morning and say, I am going to hurt a black man or a Hispanic man or whatever the case may be. And while there are certainly some policemen that feel that way, I don't think that even the ones who are committing some of these crimes wake up in the morning thinking that way. But because of things like the war on drugs, mm-hmm. and the criminalization of black men, you created a prejudice,
yes.
that is unavoidable. And so while they may not think they're better than, or think they wake up in the morning about, you know, thinking about killing a man,
mm-hmm.
they do wake up in the morning and it's unavoidable,
yeah.
with a prejudice that, hey, that black man has his hand in his pocket, and because I only see him as a criminal,
yeah.
there is something criminal going on, so I have to be on edge.
Yeah. I mean, that ties directly into that, and the three strikes rule, which came under Bill Clinton, which put all these black men in prison for life for things like dealing weed. So, gosh, I really wish I could talk to you more about this part of it, but I want to talk to you. So I have another two-part question. I'm going to talk about opioid and steroid use for pain in the NBA and why cannabis is better, and then why you decided to become a producer, a cannabis producer.
Well, the first part is people who know me know that I come from an athletic family. My dad played in the NFL. My older brother played in the NFL for 12 years almost. So sports and pain, you know, I understand them extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually my older brother who introduced me to cannabis. And it was after I finished playing and he used to tell me all the time, dude, you need to smoke something because you're too wound up. That was always his thing to me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I never paid attention to it because I was an athlete and I was in the NBA and it was illegal. And so there was all of these things to keep me away from it. But in terms of cannabis versus, you know, and pro sports and opioids, it's totally different. If you are You know, and this is all anecdotal because the government won't allow us to do much in terms of actual scientific research. However, anecdotally, which means a lot of people have tried it and a lot of people mm-hmm. agree with it. Cannabis is an anti-inflammatory, and there actually is science behind that. Cannabis is a motor neuron insulator. So things like Parkinson's disease and epilepsy, things that deteriorate your motor neurons, cannabis, certain cannabinoids actually help the body produce insulation so you don't lose those motor skills nearly as quickly. So you've got anti-inflammatory. There's actually a strain. One of the strains that we grow now is an appetite suppressant.
That's odd for a weed to be an appetite. I know, right?
we call it skinny weed. And it also impacts insulin resistance. Mm. This particular strain, it has a compound in it that helps fight insulin resistance. So from the diabetic standpoint, but back to sports. So let's just talk about sports. And I started this early on in this conversation. I started with, no one uses marijuana for recreational reasons, or very few people use marijuana for recreational reasons. That's where athletes and opioids and cannabis, that's where it all comes together. You finish a game. I can tell you as a broadcaster, you know, I would be dog tired at the end of a game, but my mind was so wound up from what I had just seen and all of the action that sometimes it would take me 5, 6, 7 hours to come down.
Yes.
Well, you know, you think about a traveling party for an NBA team. And if you don't know, then I'll kind of go through an NBA day, let's call it a 3-day run for an NBA team. You play on Monday. Let's say you play at home. Then you get on a plane Monday night after the game. You fly to Denver. You get to Denver at 2:00 in the morning. You're still wound up because you never had a chance to really calm your body. You finished the game. You went to the airport. You got on an airplane. You flew to the next city. Now it's 2:00 a.m. in Denver. Mm-hmm. You're trying to get your brain, your mind to calm down so you can go to sleep because tomorrow night you got a game.
Right.
So it's already 2:00. You might not go to bed till 5:00. Mm-hmm. Even though you're just sitting in your room, you're watching TV, you're scanning the internet, you're doing whatever it is you do. But now it's 5:00 in the morning and you're just getting to sleep. And sleep is the biggest factor in physical recovery. If you don't get 7 hours of sleep, your body's not recovering, your mind's not resetting, all of these things, right? Mm-hmm. So now you have to sleep till, we'll call it midday. But you can't sleep till midday because if you sleep till midday, you won't be ready to go by the game that night. Mm. So it's a whole big thing, right?
Yeah.
So towards the end of my career as a broadcaster, I started making different types of oil. Mm. And just as we got off the plane in the new city, so we get to Denver, I would take some of the oil. And by the time I got to my room, the oil had started to kick in. Mm. And I was able to calm my mind enough to go on and get some good rest. And that's where the idea behind Legends as a brand got started. That was the inception of it. But then as a producer, it was really just kind of fate. There's no other way to describe it. So my wife's family has been in the nursery business. So that's a tree nursery. Mm-hmm. So they've done shrubs and trees and stuff like that for almost 90 years that her family's been in this industry. So I've been around her family and their farm and all of this kind of stuff, you know, 10 years now. Well, when cannabis became legal in the state of Oregon, as it was becoming legal, I started looking at ways that we could get into the industry because it was going to be a great opportunity and it was so new. And from a business standpoint, it just made sense. So that's what we did. We converted one of the small buildings on her dad's tree farm mm-hmm. into a cannabis grow. Me and my brother and her brother went together and created this company. And then about a year later, we decided it was time to expand and they didn't really have space for us to expand on that piece of property. So we bought a bigger piece of, not a bigger piece of property, but a bigger building. And we expanded our production facility and we've actually upgraded since then even. So now we are 7 times larger than we were when we started 4.5 years ago.
Wow. That's incredible. And that's really fast growth, right?
Well, it's all according to what the industry allows. Mm. And, you know, if you go into this thinking about growing a bunch of weed and smoking a bunch of weed and getting high, you're never going to be successful.
Yeah.
You have to treat it like any other business that you, any other production business that you run. Mm-hmm. It's about creating efficiencies. It's about figuring out how to cut your cost as low as you can. And it's taken us time, but we're finally in a place where we can do that. Our building is 7 times larger, but our production costs only increased by 50%.
Wow. So we talked about how the system is kind of set up against black men, period, but especially black men who are in possession of cannabis. Do you feel like the system, actually, I want to ask you about something else too, because I read, and I don't know if this is true, but I read that when you applied for your license to become a producer distributor, that is the year that they let you go from broadcasting, or the time that they let you go from broadcasting. Is that true?
Yes. It was, you know, they said that that wasn't the reason. You know, the official word from the Trailblazers to me was that one had nothing to do with the other. But come on, I'm not an idiot. And I understood, you know, for me, it was, you're coming out of this Jailblazer era. We just talked about that.
Right.
And the last thing that they wanted to do was go back and have people reassociate the team with that. So I completely understood. Interesting story, if you don't mind,
no,
if
please.
You can indulge me. So the way it went down was, it was a Saturday night, maybe 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. I'm sitting in bed with my wife. My phone rings. I pick it up. It's my boss. And he says, hey, we're having your annual review on Wednesday. So, you know, can you come in?
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, I can come in. I hung up the phone and I looked at my wife. And I was like, that was really weird. Now, keep in mind, I was already on edge because when my name was announced as a cannabis producer, it was front page news here in Oregon. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm already a little on edge. And then I get this phone call at 8:30 at night. And the first thing I did was I went down and got my contract and, you know, to see what was going on and how many years I had left and all of this kind of stuff and fireable offenses. And so I looked through the contract and it didn't really seem like I had done anything wrong. But just to be safe, I called a wrongful termination attorney that Monday morning. When Monday came, I called the guy, talked to him, and gave him my story. And he was like, well, if you feel like you're going to be fired, take your contract. And if they let you go, call me and I'll jump right in. Like, don't say another word after that. I'll take it from there.
Right.
So we get into this meeting. It's an 8:30, 9 o'clock meeting, whatever time it was. I get there. My boss comes in and he's kind of making small talk. And then all of a sudden his boss comes in and legal comes in.
Uh-oh.
So now I definitely know this is not going to go well.
Right.
So we're talking and, you know, small talk. And then they get to the part where they're going to let me go. And, you know, we're going to go a different direction and we're eliminating the position and we just want you to know we love you and all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're talking, I'm reaching into my bag to get my contract, right? Because I'm about to call this attorney to make sure that I get what I'm deserved. And then my boss's boss says, but don't worry, you've got another year left on your contract. We're going to pick up that year because you're a good dude and we know you treat you, you know, so I slid my contract back into my bag and I said, so you're going to pay me full year to do nothing. And he said, oh yeah, we think that's the right thing to do. I said, sign me up for that, brother. And then he said, and we just want you to know, if you ever want to come to a game, feel free to give us a call. I said, you'll never see me again. I've been back to the arena one time, and that was for a promotional event for a different company that I was working with. But I've been blessed in that I moved around a lot through college and then as an NBA player. I never developed those super tight connections with a team.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing I'm truly connected to is my family.
Yes.
And the rest of it can be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
So when they let me go, I swear it was not even a thought. It was like, cool.
Deuces.
Pay me my money. I'll see you when I see you.
Yep.
And that was it.
Nice. I'm glad that that's the other part of that story, because when I read that, it was kind of jarring. I found online also this guy, Kevin Murphy. I don't know what the name of his company is, but it says he's one of the CEO of, he's the CEO of one of the nation's most lucrative marijuana companies.
Yes, that would be Acreage Holdings.
Acreage Holdings. Sorry, yeah, I do have the name. $12.9 million the first quarter of this year, what he made. And I just thought that was interesting, so that there's, this is a very lucrative business, or it could be a lucrative business that you're getting into. And yet the system seems set up to keep Black people out of it. Or do you think the system's set up to keep Black people out of it? Do you think that Black people just don't know? Or do you think that there is, it's difficult for Black people to get in? Because right now, obviously, there are many more Black men in prison doing time for marijuana possession than there are legitimate dealers and producers.
I would say it's a combination. I think that the system, first and foremost, is not set up for Black people. And really, to be honest, with the exception of Oregon, it's not set up for the average to poor person to get in. Mm. Meaning, you know, the state of Oregon, they may have erred on the side of caution in that they allowed, you know, the license fee is $5,000, mm-hmm. right? That's what it costs you to get the actual license for a production facility or processors or distro license or whatever way you want to get in. It's $5,000. That means it literally opened it up for everybody, which that can be a negative, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's other places like New York, it's $13 million or some outrageous number like
for
that.
For a license.
And that's kind of the norm. Damn. Right. It's really expensive. Ohio at one point, Ohio was only allowing seven producer licenses in the entire state. Mm. And it was ultra expensive to get in. Mm-hmm. So there's that. So there's the economic barrier to get in. But I think the bigger barrier that we deal with is the leftover of the war on drugs, where we are because of the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. You know, I called my mom when we first got in. I said, "Hey, mom, we're getting into the cannabis industry." And she like lost it. "You're going to go to jail." Mm. And I'm like, no, it's legal. And it took her a long time to wrap her head around the idea of legal marijuana, legal cannabis.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a big part of it. But then also the system is not set up for us to be successful because it's not set up for poor people or people of average means to be in. The only other guy, well, there's a couple of other guys, but the biggest name guy that I can bring up is Al Harrington, who's also a former NBA player. Mm. He's having some success. He's having a tremendous amount of success. I don't want to belittle what dude is doing. He is absolutely killing the game with Viola. So, you know, Al is having some success. I think it's Calvin Johnson, former wide receiver with the Detroit Lions. Mm-hmm. He's got a company in Detroit, in the Michigan. He's in the Michigan market. And then there's a few guys scattered out. I believe John Sally has a small company.
Yes.
I know that Isaiah Thomas is affiliate. But you think about the guys we're talking about.
Yeah.
We're not talking about anybody of average means.
No.
We're talking about guys with deep pockets or have the ability to get to people with deep pockets.
Yes.
And a lot of us just don't have that. And so I don't think that the system is set up for Black people to be involved in the cannabis industry, despite the fact that they have locked us up by the boatload for really minor infractions. And I think, you know, Laura, you and I talked about this last week, kind of as we prepare for this, the cycle and the system that's been set up in this country. Black man gets arrested for selling marijuana. Yeah. He gets a felony. He goes to jail. He comes out. Right. Does his time, comes out. Society doesn't forgive him. Instead, he's got the stigma of being a felon. Mm-hmm. So he can't get a regular job. He can't get the kind of job that allows for vertical growth.
Right.
So what does he do? He goes back into the only game he knows, which is some sort of a narcotic. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, it's a step up, though. It's not weed anymore. It's cocaine.
Right.
Right. And now, 30 years later, those same people, there's a push for expungement for cannabis crimes. However, there's a big asterisk by it. And the asterisk is can't be violent and it has to be marijuana.
Yeah.
Well, if I went through the system and I came out and I went from marijuana to cocaine, I'm already out of the expungement pool.
Right.
Right. Then you couple how many marijuana dealers, we'll call it, wouldn't have a gun
right
on them to protect right. themselves.
Of course.
So now you are arrested with marijuana and a gun. Yep. So it instantly becomes a violent crime. Mm-hmm. So you are no longer in the expungement pool. So that to me is how the system has been set up to keep us from having these opportunities. Mm-hmm. And not just in terms of where we are today, but the way they treated us over this plant has been nothing short of, in my opinion, criminal. The government had criminalized the plant.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much research you've done or how much you know about cannabis as a medicinal drug, but almost all drugs prior to 1903, I think it was, were based on cannabis. Everything we did was cannabis based. Mm. And then in 1903, they started down the prohibition path. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was 1932, they went one step further with the prohibition of cannabis, and they did that crazy, can't even remember the name of the crazy movie. It was so out there in terms of, you know, cannabis use. And it's only gotten worse up until about 15 years ago when California went legal. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, you know, CEOs and big pharmaceutical is making millions and billions of dollars off of cannabis. But these dudes and people who look like these dudes sitting in prison can't make a dime off of it.
So what do you feel when you walk into, as a black man, into these conventions, into these rooms? Are you proud? Do you feel isolated? Do you feel like you've got something to prove? What is it like?
I'm blessed because I don't feel isolated ever. I had such a strong parental group, my grandmother and my mother and my aunts and uncles, that isolation isn't even a thing. I feel very prideful. Mm-hmm. I feel prideful that I represent the other side of what society believes about us. And I always make sure I say that right. It's not who we are. It's who they believe we are.
Right.
I feel prideful that I can represent an entire community of people that's been disenfranchised, especially where cannabis is concerned. I overheard a meeting once where Kevin Murphy and Acreage, two of my partners in Legends, are former Acreage employees. Mm-hmm. And I had an opportunity to listen in on one of their conference calls, and they were talking about equity within the cannabis space, right? Mm-hmm. So you had all of these dudes who are, you know, 40, 50 years old and older, mm-hmm. white dudes,
right,
in this meeting trying to figure out equity. And I kept listening for the voice, yeah, right? The other voice, but I never heard it. So when they hung up the phone and we were sitting around talking, I said, you know, I don't know that I want equity in the cannabis space. I want the whole pie. Mm. You know, the problem is we've always fought for equity and they give us a sliver.
Yeah.
But if I try to take the whole pie, equity sounds a lot more palatable.
Yeah. Like, oh, no, now you want to give me equity. <'Cause I'm>
right.
<anything.
laughs> Exactly. Now that I'm taking the pie.
Right. Right.
Now you want it to be equitable. Yes, but yeah, see, we're such good people. We'll actually do that. Like, we'll say, okay, you know what? Fine. Mm-hmm. You take half.
Yeah.
We'll take half.
Yes.
That's, yeah. So
we go anyway. We go high. As it were.
Yes.
As it were.
As it were. Yes.
All right. Last question. What would you say, or how would you encourage more black people to get into production and distribution? Like, what words would you give them of encouragement? What should they do?
Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid. First and foremost, do not be afraid. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy because life's not easy. But don't be afraid, and then don't stop. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a million and one obstacles. But to be honest, Lord, that's what I tell anybody trying to do anything. Don't be afraid and don't stop. There have been probably 50 times when it would have been plausible for me to stop doing this, to get out of the industry. But I just don't know how. Once I get started on a path, I am going to reach my destination come hell or high water. And so that's the mindset I would encourage in young people, and especially young black people. Man, go do it. Don't let anybody tell you that you can't or you shouldn't. Once you set your mind to it, don't stop until you reach your destination. So I think that would be the number one message for me is go, go. And when you get tired, mm-hmm. get your ass up in the morning and go some more. Like, yeah, there's no options, no other opportunities.
Keep pushing, as it were.
Keep pushing. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And when you start feeling stress, the beautiful thing is you can walk right out in your garden.
Right.
And either, right? You can either pick some bud,
yeah,
or for me, it's sometimes it's just being there.
Yeah.
Like being around the plants is so peaceful.
I heard that.
Well, if you ever want to come find out, you guys are more than welcome to come join us in the garden one day. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Scott's nodding yes.
Yeah, I would love to come check it out.
Okay. So what's next for you, Antonia?
Legends is about to take off. So Legends to me was, it's everything I've ever wanted to do. It's a true entrepreneurial opportunity. It's something that hasn't been done before. It's the marriage of, it's what Big Pharmaceutical is about to try to do, by the way. They're going to try to come in and create all of these products, but they're not us. Big Pharmaceutical didn't play in the NBA or the NFL. Mm. They weren't a trainer in pro sports, mm-hmm. right? We have married some of the best trainers, some of the best pharmacists, some of the best doctors in the world in one group. And now we're creating products that have a focused effect, like our pre-workout shake. It's a powder. It's cannabis in a powder form. It tastes like cherries, right? It's like a Gatorade type product. Mm-hmm. You put it in your water bottle, you shake it up, you take it about 10 minutes before you hit the gym. And by the time you get there, it's a really low dose. It's 1/5 of the average dosage for cannabis in the US. Mm-hmm. So you don't feel a high. But it calms the body just enough that your workout can be more effective. Mm. We've got a buccal spray, which is a mouth spray, kind of like a Benaca, mm-hmm. right? You spray that on your cheek after you work out, and it helps to start calming the body immediately. It's been shown to increase vascularization within the body, which is the amount of oxygen that the body can uptake. Then we've got a topical cream that was designed specifically for acute pain in a specific area. And then we've got a tincture and a gel cap that you can take orally. That's about a 10 to 15 minute onset, and it helps you sleep. Nice. So we're trying to cover all areas of being an athlete, and we really are going hard at the marketing to help people understand why this is good for them.
That's so dope. Tell me that word again, the Nutro.
Nutraceutical.
Nutraceutical, so, yes.
So our big thing when we started with Legends was we didn't want people to think we were a cannabis brand, mm-hmm. right? Because as soon as you say cannabis or marijuana or weed or whatever term you want to use, there's a stoner association.
Yes.
So we position Legends as an athlete, a sport brand.
Yes.
This is a brand for sports that just so happens to have micro doses of cannabis in it. So we are, and we're what Gatorade would be. We're what any of these other companies would be, but we added just a pinch of THC mm-hmm. to help the body calm itself, so you sleep better, so you recover better, so you live better. And our tagline is "Raise Your Game." So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to help athletes raise their game.
That's great. I'm so impressed. Tell me where people can find you if they want, or when they want. People are going to want to invest. In your nutraceutical
company. He'll
be in
the garden, actually.
Yes, he'll be in the garden. No, I know.
You know what?
Yeah, you're not on Instagram.
I am, but I'm not an Instagram guy. I'm a Facebook guy. Laura, you see my Facebook post.
Yes, you're on Facebook. Is it public? Can people find you there? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not hard to find. Just look up my name. And so, yeah, look me up. If you want to know more about cannabis, you want to know more about Legends, feel free. It's legends.club is the website for Legends. We're finishing up everything now. We finally got our packaging. I'm going to tell you something. If you're an athlete, this is more important for me. If you're an athlete and you want to know more about being a part of our team, that's where I want them to go, to legends.club.
Okay.
Because we're going to build this thing from a guerrilla standpoint. Like, everybody thought we were going after the pro. The guy. No, I want to talk to the guy who runs the Ragnar Run in Northern California, who wants to be a better runner. Talk to me. I want to talk to the guy who's on the local rugby team, but he is so passionate about rugby and he wants to be a better rugby player. Mm-hmm. Give me a holla. Yeah. I don't need superstars, because we feel so highly about our products that they're going to take care of themselves. I want every person to feel like they can be a legend.
I love it. I love it. Antonio, I'm so excited that we did this. It's so good to reconnect with you and I saw Scott on his computer looking at tickets to Portland, Oregon for our trip up to your farm while we were talking. So he'll get to talk to you about that in his Scott Talks. But thank you so much. Thank you, man. Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, it was a great chat. Thanks.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and stay tuned for our bonus after show, Scott Talks, coming up next.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.